From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Good evening. It was an item in Newsweek magazine 2 weeks ago.
This week, the news media, especially on cable, buzzed with the story of a runaway story. It quoted an anonymous Pentagon source who said that an incident of Koran desecration at Guantanamo would appear in an upcoming official report. Before publication, the item was put before another Pentagon source for a quick check, who offered no comment on the Koran part. Newsweek ran the item. Peaceful protests turned to riots in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and people died. The original source retracted. Soon after, so did Newsweek.
We feel terrible about the violence and the role that Newsweek's reporting has played in it.
The story about the story offers some real insight into the pitfalls of some standard journalistic practice, the risks in relying on a single anonymous source, the imprecision that can lead a reporter to mistake silence for confirmation, the competitive reflex that rushes to print a story about something in an upcoming report that may well prove not to be there. But the complicated story was simplified in the coverage, reduced to just another sally in the culture war. White House spokesman Scott McClellan.
This report has had very serious consequences. People have lost their lives, and the image of the United States abroad has been damaged by this report.
Plus, America's reputation flushed down the toilet. What's Newsweek doing to fix this mess?
Did Newsweek flush America's reputation down the toilet? Did Newsweek kill people? On the latter, the government can't quite agree. The White House says yes. The Pentagon, or at least General Richard Myers, says signs point to no.
It's a judgment of our commander in Afghanistan, General Eikenberry, that in fact the violence that we saw in Jalalabad was not necessarily the result of the allegations about disrespect for the Koran, but more tied up in the political process and the reconciliation process that President Karzai and his cabinet is conducting in Afghanistan. He thought it was not at all tied to the article in the magazine.
In the end, of course, this was not an argument over the truth of a news story or even the impact of a news story. It was a proxy argument about the news media. Sean Hannity.
I think in an effort to get the president and hurt the Republicans, I think they were just all too giddy to find the next Abu Ghraib story, which is part of a problem we have, an ongoing problem with the liberal media.
Abu Ghraib happened. There are many reports from former detainees of Koran desecration at Guantanamo. Some are under investigation. At least one case, according to a story in the New York Times, citing both a former detainee by name and a former interrogator anonymously, said a senior officer delivered an apology over the camp's loudspeaker, vowing to stop such abuses. Carl Cameron of Fox News.
Some compare Newsweek's error to the CBS 60 Minutes scandal over Dan Rather's use of evidently forged documents to criticize the president's military record.
Actually, it's a useful comparison. The president's spotty National Guard service record, solidly sourced in other news reports, was effectively buried under the scandal of Rather's forged documents. Reporters make mistakes. They should be held accountable, just as they hold others to account. But allowing errors of judgment to obscure or obstruct the job of journalists is currently the game of choice, and it's a dangerous game. This week, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, echoing Press Secretary Ari Fleischer's warning in 2001, said people, meaning reporters, need to be very careful about what they say. Pat Buchanan went further, suggesting that reporters pack up their notebooks and go home till the war's over.
I don't care if the item was true or false. It doesn't make any difference. You don't do something like this, which damages a cause for which your countrymen are dying and puts at risk the boys and men we sent over there.
The Washington Post's veteran editor Ben Bradley once observed that all governments lie. Reporters famously screw up. But that can't deter them from telling the truth when they can, the best they can. Like soldiers and governments, they are far from perfect. But like soldiers and governments, we need them. Especially, that's right, Buchanan, especially in time of war.
It's still not clear what role exactly the Newsweek story played in the mobilization of the violent protests. What is very clear, if it wasn't before, is that news outlets in the United States can no longer expect that their products will be consumed in other parts of the world the same way they're consumed here at home. quote, things turned out horribly, Newsweek's Michael Isikoff said this week, referring to the violent protests. But it was unforeseen, he said. A very strange set of circumstances led to a very horrible chain of events.
Could he have foreseen it? With satellite TV blanketing regions once monopolized by state-controlled media and internet cafes cropping up in Kabul, with street protesters recording clashes on camera phones and soldier bloggers sending dispatches around the world, media production is rapidly falling into the hands of media consumers, who in turn refashion the news to suit themselves. Reporters can't control how others use their work, and governments can't control the media flowing across borders. At the moment, no one is directing traffic on the information superhighway. This week, we'll focus on media convergence and confusion as our contribution to Think Global, a week-long series of public radio programming on the theme of globalization.
We start with the story of a journalism professor and reporter in southern Minnesota named Doug McGill. 2 Decembers ago, hundreds of Ethiopian refugees in his community started receiving frantic phone calls from their relatives back home. Ethiopian soldiers had marched into the town of Gambela near the Sudan border and were systematically murdering villagers there. McGill heard about the calls, interviewed the refugees, and wrote about it on his blog. In so doing, he broke the story of the massacre of more than 425 people, part of the Ethiopian government's ethnic cleansing campaign against the ethnic Anuak minority. His story was then picked up by local, national, and international media. In other words, it was a scoop reported from thousands of miles away. It would have been unimaginable before the proliferation of cell phones and the internet, and it points to brave new reporting possibilities. McGill calls it glocalized journalism, which he defines as the illumination of, quote, invisible strands of mutual influence connecting every town and city to the rest of the world. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob.
Give me some examples, besides the ethnic cleansing one, of glocalized stories.
One of my first stories was I just walked into the local Penny's department store, and I picked up the first 30 pairs of socks that I found, and I made a record of where they were made, and most of them were made in China, and some were made in South America, and 2 were made in the United States. And I also found in the gift shop in the same mall where I was that the coffee cup for my town, which is Rochester, the coffee cup called the I Love Rochester coffee cup was also made in China. And I wrote about that. I just wrote about the experience of going to my local mall and finding out where things were made.
Since time immemorial, newspapers have been finding local angles to international events by writing about the infamous area man, the local man, the cliched gimmick for finding that precious local angle. How is glocalized journalism any different?
Well, I really think of glocal journalism not really as a strategy to come up with a story for tomorrow's newspaper. It's more like an ethical standard that I try to apply to every story I write. Just about every story that you can think of written in journalism, if you just set aside the time to ask yourself, what's the largest possible, useful, and applicable context of the story? In today's world, it's usually a global context. So I think it's the journalist's responsibility to illuminate that context. I think the idea of glocalism, it has that moral quality to it to figure out what's the impact of what we do on others and what's the impact that others have on us. So in that sense, I think of it as the golden rule in journalistic terms. It just turns out that it's a great strategy for getting wonderful scoops and stories as well.
It sounds like you're saying that glocalization is almost the reciprocal of the area man cliche, in that it's finding a local manifestation of a story and going out and finding the international explanation.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, it goes both ways. It's the local impact of international events, and it's the international consequences of local events sometimes.
Does this really mean that you're doing some sort of special sort of glocalized journalism, as you call it? Or does it just mean that technology has created a situation where in order to be a foreign correspondent, you neither need to be abroad nor to have a gigantic news organization behind you like the New York Times where you once worked or like Bloomberg where you once were a foreign correspondent? Doesn't it just mean that you can do lots of things in your basement that before you had to have a press card to do?
I think both things are true. I think the technology really makes new ways of journalism possible, and it does empower the small person without a lot of resources. But I think also that the global philosophy is something that opens your eyes to possibilities, and it suggests avenues for research and for journalism that you wouldn't otherwise see. There's a methamphetamine epidemic going on in Minnesota right now, and it's been going on for some years, and it's really a terrible problem. But I've yet to see one story in Minnesota so far, except on my website, that explains that the methamphetamine epidemic started in Thailand and came to Minnesota and other places in the United States. And I've yet to see a really good story explaining how that happened and how the Thai people responded to its epidemic pretty effectively in ways that we could actually learn from.
One of the advantages of writing about foreign events from Rochester, Minnesota, is that you are not inhibited against the many attacks on press freedom that occur where bad things are happening abroad. How much influence does just the protection of writing from within the United States afford you?
Well, I think, for example, with the case of the AnuAC, it's enormous and definitive. I literally don't worry about getting a knock on the door at night from a member of the Ethiopian Defense Forces. And you can bet that I would have a lot to worry about if I was publishing this in Ethiopia, for example. We have such freedom in the press in the United States. And everyday journalists have this opportunity to go out and write fearlessly about society and about the world. And I just think that journalism as it's practiced in the United States doesn't use that freedom enough to the advantage of people who need it. And the internet gives us the possibility to use journalism in the United States to the advantage of people around the world who need these freedoms. We can write about problems in Ethiopia or Mexico or Russia or Iraq, and yet the stories can get there and can get widely distributed, and they will be used by the local populations to improve their lives. In a sense, it's the facts carrying themselves.
Doug, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Doug McGill is an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and a blogger at McGillReport.org.
Coming up, how individuals and nations try and fail and try again to set rules for the vast uncharted territory of cyberspace.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You're listening to the national anthem of Sealand, the world's smallest country, roughly 600 square feet. Ruled by Prince Roy Bates, his wife Joan, and their son Michael, Sealand boasts its own flag, currency, and postage stamps. Back before it was a nation, it was an abandoned World War II anti-aircraft deck built 7 miles off the east coast of Britain. But Bates saw its potential for freedom, if not glory, and declared sovereignty in 1967. In 2000, the royal family broke with tradition and opened its borders, so to speak, leasing its territory to a company called Haven Co. that sought to use Sealand's special status to evade laws governing information on the Internet. Jonathan Cedar co-directed a documentary about Sealand called From the Sea, Freedom. He told us how Sealand's independent status was upheld in the mid-70s after an international incident landed the prince in British court.
Michael, the current prince regent, the son of Roy, was out on the deck with his sister, who was nude sunbathing. And these British naval buoy servicemen came by and, as Michael put it, were passing lascivious comments about his sister. And so Michael pulled out a .22 caliber rifle and essentially fired on this British naval destroyer. Of course, you know, when they came back to Britain, as they have to for food and fuel and whatnot, they were arrested and brought to British courts, and they were found not guilty because they were not within the British jurisdiction at the time, being 7 miles off the coast.
The Bateses were hemorrhaging money to maintain this principality on a platform, and people kept coming up to them with fairly shady business schemes. And then 5 years ago, a couple of young men representing a company that they would call Haven Co. came up with an offer that the Bateses thought they couldn't refuse. What was Haven Co.?
Haven Co. was what's called a data haven, so essentially an offshore bank for information. Think of it, you know, like a Swiss bank account where no other government can get its paws on your private stash of information. And so it could be used to run illegal businesses, perhaps online gambling. It could be used to store email so that it couldn't be subpoenaed by a government. And theoretically, it could be used to make financial transactions that were not traceable by any other government.
So what were the unique characteristics of Sealand? The fact that simply there were no laws?
Essentially, they didn't have any agreements with any other nations pertaining to electronic business and the storage of information. You know, the you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back that all other nations participate in. Let's say Enron wanted to store their email at Sealand, and the United States government then tries to subpoena Enron's email. And then the Sealand government says, well, we don't have any extradition treaties with you, and throws the computers into the ocean.
Jonathan Cedar is the co-director of the documentary From the Sea, Freedom. Sean Hastings was the co-founder and CEO of Haven Co. Enron never was a client. The only customers interested in Haven Co. were online gambling brokers. In fact, when someone proposed some actual illegality, streaming Hollywood films, Haven Co. crumbled. But Hastings never lost heart.
Doing it was an interesting political statement to say, here's the internet, and you're going to have to stop trying to regulate it because it's just not going to work. It's going to flow across borders freely. We started with an area which had fallen through the cracks and kind of had no law.
And that would relate to free speech, but it would also relate, at least in terms of Haven Co.'s initial idea, to financial invisibility, everything from shielding emails from government scrutiny to money laundering.
Indeed. And the whole cypherpunk ideology that I was a part of at the time was in that direction, that transactions talking about who owed what to whom very much were speech. They were just information flow. It was just data. And any attempt to regulate these things in the long run just hurts everybody.
Do you think there should be any restrictions on web content?
No, I don't think there should be any restrictions on speech at all. Speech should be protected, and anybody should be able to say whatever they want, pass any information along that they want.
One of the rules that Haven Co. did subscribe to was no child porn.
And that was a concession to the people that had created Sealand. They thought that that was the worst possible thing that could be done that people might come after us for, and probably so. You look at things that are evil and wrong, and laws have been passed to make content based on that also evil and wrong.
So perhaps there's a commonly held set of ethics that simply the cyber world subscribes to, and I don't know whether you do or you don't.
I don't know what those commonly held set of ethics are, but I have no problem with the idea of turning off a channel you don't want to listen to. I think that's the main control that should be put on speech. If you don't want to hear what somebody's saying, you don't listen.
We were told that one of the main reasons why Haven Co. went under is because a lawyer there was very nervous when the idea came up to stream movies. They were afraid that pressure would come from America on England, who would disrupt Haven Co.'s operations. Is copyright a big issue for one of these non-governmental structures that you want to create?
One of the things that we were very much hoping to do was have a place that would challenge the whole idea of copyright.
And you don't believe in intellectual property rights?
I don't believe in intellectual property rights at all. I really don't. I believe that the whole concept of property as it is used to benefit society is used to allocate scarce goods. Ideas are not scarce goods. In fact, the whole beauty of them is that they're not, that they transfer from one person to another and you don't lose it when you give it to somebody.
You've moved on to something called seasteading now. Can you explain what that is?
I've been working with a few other people, and we have been talking about the possibility of floating structures in international waters and creating communities where basically there are no rules but what the people want for themselves. We're looking to create a new frontier, basically, where new ways of living and doing things can be tried out outside the restrictions of current society. We're actually currently at a time where the frontier has vanished. Or maybe their only place left right now is the surface of the ocean.
But you're not talking about, you know, a floating nudist colony. You're talking about basically communications networks.
I believe that advances on the way we're living now occur through the creation of new ideas. And new ideas occur because people exchange a lot of information back and forth. The more of that you have, the better it is for society.
Do you need a non-governmental place like Haven Co. to accomplish a lot of what you say you want to accomplish?
I would say it's not absolutely necessary. That having the right kind of encrypted networks would allow people to exchange information without fear of it being eavesdropped on by government or anybody else. However, having some place where people are publicly saying this is right and we're doing it because it's right puts a lot of pressure on governments around the world to let their people be a bit freer.
Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Hastings was the co-founder of Haven Co. So there seems to be three camps when it comes to the question of governing the internet: no governance, governance by an international body, and governance by treaties among countries. John Palfrey is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. He says it depends.
It depends on what issue specifically that you're worrying about. So spam would be one example where I think there are relatively consistent views about the fact that spam is an annoyance. But within each country, there are different views about what constitutes free speech and how much regulation is appropriate in a zone like this. So with spam, for instance, I think there will be a number of different national laws, and there'll be coordination of enforcement by national governments. But also, most of the decisions will be made by users, those of us who are using computers and making decisions about what we want to filter out at a personal level.
But on a personal level, intellectual property becomes something of a sticky wicket. We know it was for Sealand. In fact, it almost sunk that project.
Intellectual property is one of those issues that I think belongs nowhere in the internet governance space. Every country that participates in some fashion in the global economy has intellectual property rules. The World Intellectual Property Organization already has a structure for dealing with this problem. It's already a mess. And in some ways, the last thing we need is somebody else to get involved in intellectual property wars.
What about privacy as a specific issue for the world to agree on?
I honestly think the two hardest things to regulate in the internet space on a global basis are going to be civil liberties like privacy and speech, because the underlying principles are so specific to individual cultures. So if you wanted to try to set some global rule around privacy, I don't think you're going to be able to do it. I don't think you'll get past the first base. Ditto for speech. I think we see this in the internet filtering context as well, where China and places like Iran and Saudi Arabia block lots of access to internet information of their citizens and block the ability to publish, whereas we don't do that so much in the United States. And whenever you get into this international negotiating context, things like privacy and speech, which bring up these very core values, tend to be the places where the discussion breaks down the fastest.
So it strikes me then that you think the internet simply is ungovernable on a global basis.
I don't think that at all. In fact, there's this whole strain of thinking from the mid-90s that the internet is, by its nature, unregulable. I don't agree with that. The Lawrence Lessig school of thought in this space is that it's four things that govern the internet. It's laws of the sort that you're talking about, treaties and things passed by governments, but also it's markets, what companies end up doing. It's the technology itself, very importantly, the code and the architecture, things that Google and Microsoft and others build. And lastly, it's social norms that have huge effects, the kinds of things like peer-to-peer file sharing, the fact that many people, though they know it's wrong, still manage to violate copyright on a daily basis. And I think in internet space, it's the multiplicity of those factors governing at all times that's actually having the effect.
Let's pull out one of those strands you just summarized for us, that of the companies that seem to dominate the internet. A lot of these are multinationals. They aren't quite stateless organizations, but they sometimes act that way.
That's right. I think that the most important law on the internet is made by big American corporations of the sort like Google, Microsoft, Intel, and by creating the computer code and setting the policies like Google's AdSense policy as to what constitutes an okay ad to run on their network, these are the most important and effective rules that are set on the internet, and they're not particularly regulated in the way that they do this.
Let's flash forward about 10 years. How do you expect the internet to be governed?
I think the internet will increasingly be governed through countries. I think that the geopolitical reality is that countries will realize that they can control parts of the internet and they can coordinate their efforts to deal with the most important problems. But I think you also will continue to see a growth in the importance of the technology itself in terms of setting rules. And you also see that users will continue to fight back against these other assertions of control. I think if you look at the copyright wars, for instance, in intellectual property, you see the tug of war between individuals who feel they should be able to do things that are different and more creative than what the laws permit, and the states and the companies that are trying to sell stuff. I think you'll continue to see this struggle, and I don't think it'll be resolved in 10 years, honestly.
Well, John, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
John Palfrey is the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and a lecturer at Harvard Law School.
During China's ascendancy as an economic juggernaut, the internet has been central to the nation's strategy because without it, there is no access to the global information economy. But in an authoritarian state, information is a double-edged sword. Thus has the government paradoxically cultivated the internet and stifled it, using electronic filters and an immense security apparatus to squelch dissent. And some of its worst fears were realized last month when anti-Japan activists used email, online chat rooms, and text messaging to organize demonstrations that rapidly turned violent. China's leaders had let anti-Japanese nationalism be the exception to the suppression of political speech online. But according to Zhao Xiang, director of the Berkeley China Internet Project at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism, even that proved to be a force beyond the government's control. The demonstrations seemed to be at once organized by many and by none. There were hardly any identifiable ringleaders.
That really put the government on guard. What they're afraid is not what they're demanding, it's the way they organize. So right now what you see in China is this ongoing crackdown.
Review for us, please, all of the many ways in which China does control the flow of information. I guess it begins with the fact that the internet in China isn't really part of the global internet, is it?
That's right. There's only 6 main networks in China, and all their gateways are tightly controlled by the national security forces, so they can filter anything goes between the internet inside of China to the global internet. Very often this being called the Great Firewall.
But as we watch hackers around the world defeating almost every barrier in order to send out viruses and worms and create other mischief, is even the Great Firewall of China impenetrable by those who would wish to subvert it?
Well, the Great Firewall is a good metaphor, but it's really not about absolute control of the information. It's about effective control of the information. In other words, yes, hackers or the tech-savvy users inside of China or outside China can get through it, but the general blocking mechanism there is not only just to blocking information, but also to send a strong signal to intimidate the Chinese internet users to tell them their presence inside of the Great Firewall. In almost every city, there is a what we call keywords filtering system, which whether you are in a chat room, whether you are a blogger writing your blogs, or whether even you're on those online instant messaging services, all these companies are required to block out certain keywords as a mean to intimidate the users. And we're talking about over 1,000 keywords, and they're constantly updating and changing.
Well, let me ask you about that. When Google and Microsoft go to do business in China, what kind of deal with the devil do they have to strike, and what implications does that have for the global information economy?
China has established over 37 laws and legal regulations since 1994 to sort of establish the boundary of what can be said and what can be used online. Every internet company, whether you are Chinese domestic ones or the international ones such as Yahoo or Microsoft, once you go into China, you have to operate under those internet regulations. Otherwise, you will not have a license.
Are companies like Google and Microsoft then, like missionaries who put on the local costumes in order to fit in with the local culture, or are they collaborators, mercenaries, doing repugnant things for the sake of making a buck?
Well, I think they are there making a buck. I don't think those major companies such as Yahoo or Google or Microsoft can commercially afford not to go to China. The question here is how the Chinese internet users are using those commercial companies, information technologies, and to what degree the police forces can actually control those informations.
As internet and cell phone penetration increases, and these devices are in the hands of hundreds of millions of people, how can even this authoritarian regime, with all its resources, continue to keep a lid on this baby?
Well, in the long term, I think you are asking a right question. Right now, China has many sort of urgent issues, from corruption to the uneven divide of the wealth and the increasing gap between the coast regions and the inner lands. There's many potentially explosive issues. Chinese government, they think they simply by economic growth that they can maintain the stability of the society. But the communication technology certainly challenging that way of thinking, because the more and more people know a lot of things, more and more people can communicate among themselves and organize among themselves. The official way to centralize everything, to control what people know and to shape what people say, is not as effective as it used to be.
All right. Well, Xiao, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Xiao Cheng is director of the Berkeley China Internet Project at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism.
Google may knuckle under to the Chinese, but it stands up to the French. Up next, old and new takes on cultural imperialism.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Google, the world's most popular internet search engine, was devised during its developers' early attempts to digitize libraries. With the search business booming, Google has returned to its roots in an ambitious endeavor to digitize the world's books. The project, called Google Print, is beginning with the collections of four colleges and the New York Public Library, but Google is not stopping there, which is raising some eyebrows internationally. Leading the chorus of anxiety, predictably enough, was the president of the National Library of France, who fears a super search engine of the world's books controlled by an American company will inevitably exacerbate American cultural imperialism. Jean-Noël Jeanneney's concerns prompted the European Commission to fund its own European digital library, and he joins us now from Paris. Jean-Noël, welcome to the show.
Thank you for welcoming me.
When did you first learn of Google's plans, and what was your immediate reaction?
Well, my reaction was satisfaction. It was obvious for me that it was one important step in the direction of what we all dream of, which is the possibility to give to a world audience access to huge parts of human culture.
But you clearly are no longer quite as sanguine about the plans. What is your principal objection?
You must understand I have nothing against it. I think Google is quite a precious invention. We all use Google. But I think you in America know very well how dangerous it could be to have only this private-owned and American searching engine dominating all over the world. You are the country who has invented the Sherman Act against monopoly.
How does the storage of book pages, pages that ultimately will be accessible to anyone in Europe and elsewhere, how does that threaten France?
It's a question of hierarchy. It's a question of page ranking. We believe that it will be quite normal to expect American libraries to organize that page ranking in a way which will be, of course, influenced by the American civilization. I didn't want this American mirror to be proposed all over the world to all the peoples. I wanted them to be able to choose and to make their own opinion through getting to the different possibilities of the cultural look to the, our history and our actuality.
You're just suggesting that the tendency of Americans to look at American works will automatically relegate French authors and other non-American authors to a lower page rank and thus become a kind of perpetual motion machine for overemphasizing works most interesting to Americans.
As you know, Google's algorithm is mysterious. We do not know it. It's a kind of industrial secret, like the way you create Coca-Cola. But what is clear, as far as normal Google is concerned, is that there is a tendency to go to sites which are already well known.
Isn't it possible that the Google technology will actually be a force to defeat American cultural imperialism because it will reflect the usage patterns of people worldwide?
I know that the motto of Google is the ambition to organize the information of the world. When you say you organize, you are not only a passive mirror. Google is bound to propose things as a kind of an enormous dictionary with a coagulation of facts, facts, and facts. Of course, if you want to know what Lincoln said, you will probably find it easily. But if you want to think on the question of relationship between democracy and capitalism, for instance, then you need to have a thread. You need to be helped. You need to have an organized corpus. We don't want to have only bits of information, but to propose our own organization of the culture of the world. For instance, we have created and maintained the French cinema. We don't want to have dumping to invade our screens, so we have protected ourselves. In the field of internet, it's not possible to have a defensive attitude, but it's possible to have an offensive attitude. I mean, to go on and digitize ourselves, and the whole world will be richer because of that type of competition.
Very well. Well, Jean-Noël, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Jean-Noël Jeanneney is president of the National Library of France. Susan Wojcicki is Google's director of product management, and she's spearheading Google Print. She says there is no most favored nation status when it comes to Google searches, so the nations of Europe have nothing to fear.
We have a technology called PageRank, and what PageRank does is the page looks to see who links to that page. And so if a lot of pages have linked to a specific page, then we count that like a vote. It's a very democratic way of trying to understand what is important to our users. And so it's not Google coming in saying these are the most important pages. It's actually what the web has selected to be the important works. So different languages or different collections will link to their own material that they see most relevant for them. And so the net result is whatever is most relevant for an English-speaking audience would come up to the top as opposed to whatever's most relevant for a French-speaking audience.
But is the use of Google so heavily influenced by American users and linkers at this stage as to defeat, at least in the beginning, the ultimate promise of Google's even-handedness?
Over 50% of Google's traffic is non-English traffic. And so if Google were to do something in some way bias the results to be more English or more American, and that wasn't the right thing for our users, we would expect our users to go somewhere else to do their searches. In order to remain competitive from a business standpoint, it makes sense for us to offer the right results to the users, regardless of what country or language they're in.
Google, the search engine, sustains itself by selling placements on search result pages to advertisers who have paid for their messages to come up based on certain keywords.
Uh-huh.
What is the business model for Google and the books of the world?
The business model for Google Print is exactly the same as our business model for our main search. And the goal of the program as well is that you're able to come to Google, you're able to type in any word, and we are able to present books that would be relevant to your search. And when you actually go to that book and click on it, you can either find a library where you can find it, or you could actually find where you could purchase that book. And we would show advertising on the right-hand side, just like we're doing today.
On the subject of business, I think one of the things that makes the French queasy is that so many pages from so many works from so many libraries around the world will be, in effect, owned, at least the digital images, will be owned by a for-profit American company.
Our focus and our passion is on making information available that otherwise would have been unavailable. I think what Google can bring to the table that will be valuable is Google can do this at scale. So no one has been able to digitize an entire collection. No one has been able to digitize in the Harvard volume range of 14 million volumes. We're bearing significant financial costs to do this, and we believe that it's the right thing for our users and for our search and for seekers of knowledge. So if there really is real concern about one company doing this, then I would expect that the market forces would come into play and there would be another provider who would step in and do this.
Okay. Well, Susan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Susan Wojcicki is Google's Director of Product Management. She's spearheading Google Print, which is digitizing the libraries of the world.
The French have had a lot of practice lobbing charges of cultural imperialism across the sea, having long defended its film industry from the predations of Hollywood, as has the rest of Europe, now braced for another onslaught of the evil empire of George Lucas. Back in 1941, publishing mogul Henry Luce called upon America to fulfill its destiny as, quote, the powerhouse of the ideals of freedom and justice and the training center of skillful servants of mankind to create the first great American century. To that end, the Motion Picture Export Association dubbed itself the Little State Department and went forth to sell the American way of life around the world. But sometimes it did its job a little too well. As early as 1934, Clark Gable played havoc with at least one nation's economy. It happened in It Happened One Night.
Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses.
Who can answer no to such a question? Especially from the king.
Toby Miller is the director of the program in film and visual culture at the University of California, Riverside. Okay, Toby, here comes the part where Gable takes off his shirt and thereby hangs a tail.
No, I have a method all my own. If you'll notice, the coat came first, then the tie, then the shirt. Now, according to Hoyle, after that, the pants should be next. There's where I'm different. I go for the shoes next.
Now, when Garbo laughed and showed her teeth, Ninotchka soared, but when Gable stripped and bared his chest, an industry collapsed.
Absolutely. Supposedly, the good burghers of Argentina found that their warehouses were overflowing with undershirts that up till then they'd happily been able to sell because Clark Gable didn't need one. So why would the average Argentine man need one? And they went off to lobby the U.S. Embassy in Buenos Aires to say, we really can't have this. Do you understand the impact that these people are having? So you can see that in very remarkable ways, Hollywood really was able to sell a way of life, right down to the very undershirt that a gentleman of means would be seen in.
Let me ask you about the history of American film and cultural imperialism. What was the landscape like before World War I?
Prior to World War I, the United States was a net importer of movies, and it was also a net importer of a lot of film technology, film stock, in other words. But what happened with the decimation of the European film industries, particularly the French film sector in the First World War, was that suddenly our industry, which had been essentially untouched, was in a position suddenly to be a net exporter of movies and also a net exporter of technology. So that was a really key event. And the same thing with the Second World War, where again we gained a comparative advantage because European and Japanese and some Asian, other Asian film industries were deeply affected by that conflict.
In fact, didn't the Marshall Plan actually include provisions that all recipients of aid also take American films?
The Marshall Plan, which was the crucial lending and donation institution whereby the United States enabled the defeated powers of Western Europe to recuperate after the Second World War and not fall prey to the temptations of communism, was only available if you agreed to take on board Hollywood product. And so in the three or four years after the war, Italy, for example, suddenly had 2,000 films from Hollywood essentially dumped on its market.
And so did they like the films? Do they like them now?
Well, of course, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it, Brooke? Again and again, we're told, well, Hollywood's successful because people love its stories. Its stories are simple. There's romance, there's desire, there's the notion that you can, in a sense, pass away from your origins and become a new kind of person. There's a sort of secular transcendence that comes from the Hollywood dream of money, sex, power, commodities, love. Well, that no doubt is part of the appeal. But it's also about forms of distribution and exhibition that are not very competitive. It's about saying, you can have the next Spielberg movie in your local theater if you'll take this, you know, Van Damme movie that no one else wants.
You mentioned Spielberg, so let's stay with him for a moment. Jurassic Park was an enormous international hit, but it also set up a terrible conflict between Spielberg and foreign filmmakers. There was a joint letter from a variety of important foreign directors, Pedro Almodovar, Bernardo Bertolucci, Wim Wenders, and the letter said, "Dear Stephen, we're trying to defend European cinema from complete annihilation. There will be no European film industry left by the year 2000. And they lay the blame for that at the feet of Jurassic Park. What did Jurassic Park represent?
It represented, in a sense, the culmination of the blockbuster movie, the notion of there being massive advertising on television, not just in the newspapers, of there being tied-in merchandise, of there being, in a sense, the notion of an event film. And specifically, Jurassic Park represented the triumph of Hollywood in areas where it had never done well in the past. India, for example, a massive market, and also a market with its own very successful film industries, not just Bollywood, but other film industries as well. Jurassic Park simply overran the rest of the offerings that were available for film consumers at that time. What seemed to be encapsulated in Jurassic Park as this great threat to an auteur-driven or director-centered notion of film as art and not just as commerce.
But now New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman tells us that the world is flat, or that at least soon there'll be a level playing field. Do you think that'll also be true in the realm of film?
Well, fortunately, I'm not responsible for the fantasy structures that Thomas Friedman has. But to be more serious, although that in fact is a serious remark, there's no doubt that new technology and the breakdown of various barriers to financial exchange have made for a more open series of markets. However, in the case of the United States, we practice some of the most vigorous and some would say vicious cultural protectionism and state subvention of film, television, sport, and any other aspect of popular culture you could name in world history.
Are we stopping foreign film from coming to this country?
The answer is yes, but not in the conventional way one might expect. If we go back 45 years, when there were lots and lots of independent movie theaters here in the United States, 10% of the films that you or I as a potential audience member could go and see came from another country, 10%. What do you think the figure is today? It's well below 1%. Now, what are the reasons given for this extraordinary closure of our borders to foreign cultures? The reasons given by, again, the hacks and mavens of the industry and their journalistic servants and the plenipotentiary lickspittles in D.C. is, guess what? Guess what? They think it's the operation of supply and demand. Their answer is Americans have closed minds, are not interested in foreign cultures, will not tolerate subtitles, and do not want foreign languages. Well, hello and excuse me. The efflorescence of languages, cultures, and so on in the period since 1965 has been nothing short of extraordinary. The notion that these people are not interested in foreign films, quite apart from the fact that plenty of English native-speaking U.S. residents are fascinated by other countries, is simply absurd.
So Hollywood has created one-way traffic, and it's all going out. But has Hollywood also changed its product to adapt to a changing global market?
Well, this is the other irony, Brooke, because the original domestic market, which is still large and still wealthy, is no longer responsible for even close to 50% of the box office take and the overall return on investment for Hollywood movies. The foreign sector is now absolutely crucial. And so stories that are about our history, our cultures, our concerns, some argue, are actually being marginalized. And you're getting stories that fail to address questions of United States history, culture, politics, and so on, lest they be either alienating to a foreign audience or in some way just hard to understand. So a lot of us feel as though it's not just the rest of the world that's having our product dumped on them. We're having our product dumped on us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Toby Miller is co-author of Global Hollywood 1 and its white-knuckle sequel, Global Hollywood 2. Global Hollywood 1 has just been translated into Chinese.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.